I'm Matthew Petty and this is Intersection. Orlando is booming. High-rises, apartment blocks, multifamily home developments are springing up across central Florida. It's causing friction in some places. Anti-sprawl activists say they don't want their properties hemmed in with new development. And some residents worry about new building crowding out green space in the city. But development drives the economy, and there's also an opportunity to bring more people into the city and to create a thriving downtown. To talk more about how development is helping shape Orlando's future, I spoke with Paul Ellis, the group president of CNL Commercial Real Estate. We met at his office in downtown Orlando, right across from City Hall. Let's start with downtown Orlando. There's a debate raging currently over plans for a 28-story tower next to Lake Eola. How would that building really change that lakefront?
My sense is we're gonna be dealing with this issue more and more. I think the reality of it is, and we're seeing this really across the Southeast, is that as these, in our vernacular, we call them Tier 2 cities, right? You know, a typical Tier 1 city is a Manhattan or a Chicago or a Boston or Los Angeles. And these are very, very dense urban environments that, you know, tend to be land constrained. And the only way to deal with, growth is to increase your height. Well, as the Orlandos of the world and the Charlottes of the world and the Miamis of the world transition to this urban environment, then you have a density issue and you have this tension that gets created with bringing more high-rise into it. Now, from my perspective, and I know a lot of folks in downtown Orlando, I view that as a good thing. You know, when you can kind of create this urban environment, and there's always a balance, right? There's a balance between how do you have responsible development that is densified, that's urban, but it doesn't impact or it's not a detriment to the surrounding community. And certainly Lake Eola is a pretty special place in Orlando. And I know a lot of people are sensitive to, oh, are we going to wake up and there's going to be 17 high-rises and there's no free parking space. But my argument against that is there's a lot of great cities out there that have very dense urban environments, but they have great public spaces. And certainly Lake Eola is a great public space that we want to preserve, but my personal opinion is that a high-rise doesn't take away from that. In my opinion, what it does is it adds, right? Because what it's going to be, it's now I'm going to have more people that are living in that environment. I have more people that are going to be using that environment. They're going to be jogging. They're going to be having picnics on the park, and it activates those environments as opposed to take away.
Should there be some kind of limitation, though, in terms of just how high you go?
I mean, in some sense, that's always the struggle with cities, right? Because the answer to that question is my opinion, right? I mean, and there are a lot of people and a lot of residents in downtown that care about downtown just as much as I do that have a different opinion of that. So I think at the end of the day, you know, you trust your city leaders that they're responsible for what that vision is. And in my mind, having a mix of high-rise and low-rise is the appropriate answer. I don't know that I could sit here and just say it should only be 20 stories or it shouldn't go above 50 stories. I don't know what the right answer there right now is. I think the reality of it is as Orlando grows, that's an issue that we're going to have to deal with. I mean, you know, I've heard, you know, a lot of people say, well, there's not a lot of land in downtown Orlando. That's not necessarily the case. I mean, there's a lot of buildings and a lot of areas downtown that have kind of reached the end of their useful life, and we need restoration and we need renovation. And in some cases, we need to tear down some of those old buildings and put new, nice structures in place.
Where do you draw the line, though? Because if we look at that particular proposed 28-story building near Lake Eola, there's some concerns about making way for that by taking out a couple of 1920s-era buildings. And so where do you say, this building is old, it's beautiful, but we've got to kind of move things along here?
The tough part of that answer is that it's an opinion, right? I mean, there's not, you can't sit there and say what should be historic and what shouldn't be historic. And there are a lot of people out there that would say any old building should be historic. I certainly don't agree with that.
But how do you sell this idea of density to people who don't like it, though? Because you drive through, you know, the likes of College Park and you see those little billboards in people's yards, no density.
Well, I think you really are talking about two different scenarios, right? I mean, you know, there's the CBD, which is designed, you know, and should be an urban environment, which means high rise, which means living environment, and one of the things that you have to do, and one of the things that I think is part of the DTO vision, is you have to create an environment that's attractive not only for companies to work but also for people to live, right? And when you do that, then all of a sudden everything else flows out of that. Retail improves, the dining experiences improve, and downtown becomes a location that you want to be at as opposed to this place that you only visit when you work, right? I mean, that's the shift that we're trying to do. That's much different, and it's a much more politically difficult situation when you're talking about a College Park or a Winter Park or Thornton Park or Delaney Park, which are urban cities that kind of sit just outside the CBD, right? It's a much more difficult scenario. The neighbors are much more conscious about what's going on in my community and what should I do there. And it's attention, right? You know, full disclosure, I live in College Park, right? So it's attention. So I don't know that I'm giving you a good answer other than to say I think communities have to find the right balance. But as a real estate practitioner, as a developer, and certainly I have a biased view in that sense, in order to create the right kinds of environments, you have to be attractive to new residents. You have to be attractive to the millennial generation. I mean, that's a very important aspect of, you know, what we're dealing with in downtown and all these communities. And you have to create urban environments. Does that mean you should have, you know, a 28-story building on Edgewater? Probably not. I would say this, maybe this is a better answer to think about. What cities struggle with and what developers struggle with when we come into a city, and like I've developed in Winter Park and we're developing in downtown Orlando, is that when you go into an environment where there's not a refined vision and not a specific vision as to what a city wants to be, that's when this tension gets created. And the problem that I see with these cities is they often don't have a unified vision. They don't even have a process in place in some sense for government and the residents to come together and say, okay, let's agree on what we want this to be. Let's work with our zoning and our entitlement process to create these areas where we want these things to happen. And then as a developer, I can walk into that city and know ahead of time, okay, what will work, what won't work, what the residents want, what they don't want, right? When a city doesn't have that refined vision, it's left up to the process of a deal. So somebody brings a deal in, and there's a lot of debate, and it often gets very heated, and it often gets very emotional. And, you know, at the end of the day, nobody wins, mm-hmm. right? Now, when you're talking about downtown Orlando, which is one of the reasons I think the mayor has done such a phenomenal job with the DTO vision and what have you, as a developer and somebody who wants to build something in this city, I know what the goals are. I know what is going to meet the city's goals. I know what the city wants and what the residents want and what have you. And that's an exciting thing because then everybody's working together to create economic viability, to create an environment that people, you know, want to be a part of. So when a city has a vision, and Orlando, downtown Orlando in particular, has a very strong vision, then it's an exciting place to work and figure those things out.
So you're part of Project DTO. Before that committee came together, was there a vision?
Yeah, there was. And that committee, you know, that whole process was modeled after a process that was already done some time ago that had a different group. Maybe the accurate way to describe it is kind of version two of what the city wanted to be. And look, I mean, I think you're seeing the results of that original vision in Amway Center and the Dr. Phillips Performing Arts Center and the Citrus Bowl renovation and what have you. And those were kind of the first steps in those visions. And those were, in my opinion, those were the right first steps because now it was the first step in Orlando becoming a world-class city. And now we've got soccer and we've got all these other aspects that are forming out of that. So it had a vision and it was refined. And this is kind of a further refinement of that.
Paul Ellis, let me just ask you a question about Skyline. Can Orlando be, you know, a world-class city without something like a John Hancock building from Chicago or a Freedom Tower? Does it need a real significant signature piece like that to become that world-class city?
Well, I think, you know, I'll be biased. I think we do have some of those already, you know, within our scale. I think CNL1 and the architecture, if you stand at 50 and look down Orange and you see the cupola, and it's a kind of an iconic structure at the ground level looking down Orange Avenue. Certainly SunTrust Tower and Bank of America Tower have been iconic buildings in the Orlando skyline. I think ultimately, though, what creates that iconic structure is the place that it creates. It's not just the building. So, I mean, I think if your question is, do we need a 50-story building that kind of sets the tone or sets the tone for the skyline? No, I don't think we need that. What we need to build are great office buildings, and we refer to them as communities. And what are the amenities around that community, and is it a place that is attractive for people to go to as opposed to just look at?
Well, what do you think Orlando looks like 10 years out from now? Are we looking at a megapolis with gridlock traffic, or are we looking at some kind of urban planning utopia?
I think, you know, 10 years from now, will we be a much more dense city? And I'm talking about the Orlando CBD. Absolutely. Will our public transportation modes become more mature, more acceptable, and more efficient? Absolutely. I think we're seeing it already. I think SunRail has been a great success. There's story after story about people who you traditionally would look at and say they'd never ride a commuter train that now love it. You know, there's a lot of those stories. So that's been a great success. Will we be home to a lot more regional headquarters and hopefully some corporate headquarters? There's no question that we will be. I think Red Lobster's move downtown was a huge step for us as a city.
They're right next door.
And we were fortunate enough to be a part of that project and bringing them to downtown. But what was important to that? That was a company, a large 100,000 square foot office user that historically would always go to the suburbs, right? Why would they go to the suburbs? They would go to the suburbs because it was a cheaper rent. I didn't have to pay for parking, and it was all about occupancy costs. As a company, I could pay the least amount of rent and have lease, and I could spend my money, I spend capital elsewhere. What Red Lobster realized, and what I think they would tell you today, is that, yes, it's a little bit more costly to be in an urban environment, but the benefits far outweigh that cost. My employees are happier. They get outside and they walk to lunch. They don't, you know, if I'm located in the suburbs, I have to get in a car and I have to drive somewhere to lunch. They can commute to work and use public transportation. I can ride, you know, if I live downtown, I can ride my bike or I can walk to work. So now my employees are happier. They're more engaged in the culture of the city. They're generally healthier when they locate in an urban environment. And all of those, what is the result? They're more productive. They enjoy being at work. They like coming to the office as opposed to, I got to drive 45 minutes on the highway to get to my office, and then I'm going to sit in my office, and then I'm going to drive 45 minutes back. It's a completely different environment. And I think the benefits to the associates, which companies more and more are realizing, that really is what we are in. We are in a talent war, right? And so I've got to create great environments to recruit that talent, and then they need to be happy. And a lot of what goes into that equation is, where are they located? And I think the overall trend is, when I'm located in an urban environment, when I'm located in the CBD, then that's the best environment for my employees. And so I think our environment will be more dense, but it will be better for the pedestrians.
Paul Ellis is the group president of CNL Commercial Real Estate. Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Coming up after the break, Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer talks about what makes Orlando a world-class city. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer says he wants to make Orlando a city of world-class amenities and an unmatched quality of life. To do that, the city launched Project DTO 2 years ago. It's a group of community influencers who've come together to come up with a 10-year plan to develop downtown Orlando. The goal is creating a more appealing downtown core to draw businesses and residents into the city, but that could come with a hefty price tag in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer joins us to talk about the city's vision for the future, his vision for the city's future. Mayor Dyer, thank you for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, let's talk about the areas immediately around Lake Eola. They're certainly coming together around with apartments and new shops and restaurants. But the further you get out from that Eola core, the more you start seeing empty storefronts. What's the city's plan to fill in some of those empty spaces and bring all of downtown alive?
Well, the downtown itself is going to – the retail aspect of it is probably the hardest part of it, getting the residential and office market, even the hotel market. So I don't think we're going to have retail that rivals the Mall of the Millennia. It's probably not going to be as much destination retail as it's going to be retail that serves the residents and the business people that are there in the downtown.
How do things like mixed-use development around some of those SunRail stations, how does that fit into that? Because that's something that developers tell you is an important part of that development.
Well, we have a very obvious emphasis on transit-oriented development all along the SunRail line, and we've already seen, $1 billion worth of construction related to the fact that SunRail was operational. So there's apartments going right next to the Central Station, Link Central Station, that are going up right now. The Magic have their sports and entertainment complex that will have residential in it down close to Church Street. There's another tower a block north of there. So there's going to be a lot of development in the downtown area related to these SunRail stations. And then, of course, we've expanded the limo system downtown.
And that's the free bus circulator.
That's the free bus circulator. So we had an original line that we called the Orange Line, and we added the Grapefruit Line and the Lime Line, not the Lemon Line, the Lime Line, is under construction, which will be on the west side of I-4. We have a bike share program that is fully implemented now with over 200 bikes in and around the downtown and College Park and Thornton Park. And then we have a car share program down there as well.
We'll talk more about transportation in a minute, but just getting back to the retail, I mean, why is that such a difficult aspect of getting business in and revitalizing the city?
Well, again, the retail downtown is not a destination retail area. Once upon a time in the 50s, it was, but with the advent of the malls that we have all over Central Florida.
Could it be, though? Could you make it that?
It'll be a different type of destination. I think it's an activity destination. So restaurants and bars and themed type of things are probably more the destination for downtown. There will be stores. But again, I don't think it's the going to be a shopping destination necessarily.
And when you talk about activity destination, Mayor Dyer, how do you compete with the likes of Downtown Disney, even Universal City Walk? Those are pretty big magnets to attract people out of the city. How do you bring those people back in here?
I think our downtown is pretty special, and people are finding that out. Our residents, for sure, any given weekend, there are literally tens of thousands of people in and around Lake Eola. The restaurant scene is now thriving in downtown. It is a restaurant destination for sure. There are some things on the books, the Sports and Entertainment District that the Magic are doing. And, of course, with our venues, there are thousands of people that are coming down to either the Performing Arts Center, the Amway Center, the Orlando Citrus Bowl, or soon a new MLS stadium. So you're self-generating big crowds downtown with sporting and cultural events.
When you talk about all those thousands of people flooding downtown too, I mean, one of the things that people gripe about occasionally is parking. What's been done to make sure that people can park when they want to, walk to a restaurant or something like that?
Well, there's plenty of parking downtown, and we now have a Park Smart app. So you can now use... Well, we have smart parking meters. Let's start with that. So you can use a credit card or you can use a phone app to pay for that. We are putting sensors in all the on-street parking spots. So you can pull up your app and you can see which spots are available. It will also tell you which of the city's public garages is the closest one to you and which one has space available in it. So you can use technology to find your parking.
Buddy Dyer, let's talk about transportation in more detail. I mean, world-class cities have world-class transit systems, transportation systems. How would you rate Orlando's?
Well, I'd say we're catching up. I wouldn't say by any stretch of the imagination we're a leader. We were one of the cities, few cities, maybe two or three, that didn't have some form of commuter passenger rail until last year. So we've got some catching up to do. But I will say this, over the next 5 years, there's probably not a region in America that is investing more in transportation infrastructure. So between the Wekiva Parkway, which is a $2 billion plus, the I-4 Ultimate, which is $2 billion plus, Phase 2 of SunRail, the southern terminal at the airport, the five-year work plan for the Expressway Authority, that is roughly $10 billion worth of transportation infrastructure.
A lot of that is roads, though. Do you think it's too structured, too focused on private motor vehicles and not enough on mass transit?
Well, we have SunRail Phase 2. I didn't include SunRail Phase 3, which will take it to the airport, and I also didn't include All Aboard Florida, which is the fast train from Miami, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm to Orlando, which should be operational in 2017. So those were two additional investments that I didn't include.
How long do you think it is going to be before SunRail goes to the airport?
Well, we have to complete Phase 2 South first because the line would come off of Phase 2 South down near Taft. So that'll open in the middle of 2017. So we're looking at different funding opportunities and whether we can figure out an opportunity that does not involve the federal government would speed it up some. So if we can figure that out, I'd say 2018. If not, then 2019, 2020.
What about walking and cycling? I mean, there is a lot of emphasis now, and since you've been mayor, on trying to make Orlando more accessible to cyclists, safer for pedestrians, but we still feature in reports on how dangerous it is to ride a bike or walk on the streets of Orlando. So are you satisfied with what's been done there?
As a region, we rank very, very poorly in that regard. The city proper is, I don't know, 10 years running, been rated a bicycle-friendly community, and we've added hundreds of miles of bike lanes and pedestrian areas as well. And we have adopted a policy for all of our city streets called Complete Streets, which says you put as much emphasis on the biker and the pedestrian as you do on the car. And we've only done that in the last couple of years, but that will be our model going forward. We really are looking, at least in the downtown area for sure, at providing more shade. That's part of Project DTO, and completing an urban trail where you can pretty much progress north to south through the entire city. And then as a region, a lot of the fatalities and issues are in some of the major thoroughfares that are kind of more in the suburban area where people are trying to cross four-lane highways, not at the crosswalks, but in the middle with no medians, wearing black clothing at night. So some of it has to be attributed to the pedestrians as well.
Also, a lot of those roads are state roads. So, I mean, how kind of easy is it to work with state authorities to you know, make those roads safer?
You know, I think a lot more thought is being given to pedestrians along all of our roads and bicyclists, and some of our roads that are in existence today, not a whole lot of thought was given to that. So hopefully we'll make some progress here in the next decade on some of those roads.
You've been known to jump on a bike and ride to work. How safe do you feel?
Well, generally I have a police escort, so I'm always pretty safe, but I ride otherwise. And I live in College Park, and there's plenty of great places to ride, College Park and around the north part of downtown.
Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of getting from those little urban oases to from one to the other, right? I mean, sometimes the connections between them are a little hazardous.
Yes, I would agree with that, although you can transport your bike to wherever you want to go. And you can put it on Sunrail and take Sunrail wherever you want to go and get off.
And people do. You see that on holidays especially.
I do. You'd be surprised at how many bikes there are that are left on the limo or the Lynx buses or the limo buses. People bring them in. It's like, how do you forget your bike? And I suspect maybe some of those bikes might have been stolen.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, let's just a further question on Lynx. I mean, you mentioned the limo, the free bus system that circulates through the city. But Lynx in general, one congressman here wants to privatize it. Do you think that's a good idea?
Well, we've examined that several times, at least since I've been on the Lynx board, which is a little over 12 years. And it started off a long time ago as a private bus company, and we had deemed it to be in the public interest that we operate it as a public bus system. So since Congressman Micah has asked us to reevaluate that, we'll take a look at it. But my guess is the outcome will be that we'll remain the way we are. Although there's going to be interesting discussions as we move forward. The Expressway Authority is now statutorily enabled to play in the area of transit. Does it make sense for Lynx and Sunrail to be eventually one agency? There's a lot of major discussions about our holistic approach to transportation.
Right, connecting those people to Sunrail. If we just talk about development for a bit, and specifically state funding, so the downtown UCF campus and the soccer stadium, those pieces of state funding you thought were going to go to those were vetoed. How big of a dent does that put in the project in terms of setting the timeline back?
Well, let's start with soccer. We had anticipated that the legislature would simply approve the sales tax rebate that was statutorily passed last year. It didn't occur at the LBC before the session. It got punted into the session, and when the House quit 4 days early, it was languishing on the calendar and never came up. So the team itself came to me over Memorial Day weekend and said, basically, rather than wait and see whether the legislature is going to act in that regard. We're willing to self-fund the stadium, as well as pay the city for the land that you've put together for the stadium and your stormwater improvements. So that project is on track without regard to the state money. It is delayed just a little bit because they were going to increase the size of the stadium from the proposed 19.5 to somewhere between 25 and 28,000. So they needed to go back and do some redesign, but that is well underway, and we should break ground on the structure probably in the next month or so. In terms of the UCF Valencia campus at Creative Village, we're going to be able to continue the design and pre-construction effort. Dr. Hitt, Dr. Schugert, and I are working on a private philanthropy effort to raise some private dollars towards that. We'll have an opportunity to go back to the Board of Regents and to the legislature before construction is scheduled to begin. So I'm very hopeful that it won't get off track.
How surprised were you that that didn't come through? I mean, you're pretty familiar with the way the legislature works. Was that a total, you know, left field punch?
If you'd asked me a couple weeks before, I'd have said yes. The day of, I kind of saw what was going to occur, and unfortunately, it was not a harmonious legislative session, and the House and the governor were at odds with the Senate. Of course, the Senate leader, Senator Gardner, is from our area. So in retribution, I guess, the governor took down a lot of the projects that Andy had had an interest in Central Florida. And it's unfortunate because it harms not just the senator, but all of us citizens that were involved with the sensor facility down in Osceola. The DPAC money was in there. The UCF Valencia campus was in there.
If we could just talk a little bit, you know, in general terms about what these projects like the soccer stadium, like the UCF Creative Village, the downtown campus there too, how is that going to change Paramore? I mean, that's a pretty massive shift, isn't it?
Well, the UCF Valencia campus is probably the biggest game changer of them all because that's going to bring 10 to 15,000 students into downtown and into the northeast part of Paramore. More importantly for the existing residents of Paramore, however, is what Valencia is going to bring. So an opportunity with, well, in Orange County Public Schools is bringing a K-8. So you're going to have a K-8 and community college opportunity for and not even have to leave the neighborhood. So I think that's the most important aspect in terms of, I think you were asking about what to do for the residents of Paramore.
Are they excited about that?
They're very excited about it. I was in a couple of churches on Sunday where they were talking about those opportunities.
When you think about the image of the city, I mean, you talk about big cities like Seattle with its Space Needle, San Francisco with the Golden Gate Bridge, Chicago with the Cloud Gate, which people know as the kind of that silver bean. What do you think about when you think of Orlando? Do we have a visual image people can attach to us?
I don't think we have a single iconic feature, but if you want to be truthful about it, it's still probably the in the Magic Kingdom, the castle, right? If
right.
People think of Orlando. So I don't know that we're going to necessarily overcome that, but we want to be known as a arts cultural or known for that. And I would say right now our signature icon is the Lake Eola Fountain.
Mm-hmm. Is that kind of enough of an image, enough of an icon, do you think?
Well, I don't know that we're going to create some giant tower just to have a giant signature emblem. I'd rather have a bunch of sculpture, which we did with Sea Art around Orlando. We are going to the gateways into Orlando, so the bridge over Ivanhoe as you come in from the south. They will be very aesthetically pleasing, let's say.
The one thing we didn't talk about, the homeless population, that's been a pretty high-profile thing too. Are you kind of happy with where Orlando is heading in terms of making sure people get into permanent housing, that kind of thing?
So a lot of people will ask me what I'm proudest about or what's your biggest accomplishment or something along those lines. And I always say it's the fact that I've helped create a culture of collaboration and partnership. So all these big things that we talk about came about because we could work together with Orange, Osceola, and Seminole, the University of Central Florida, the development partners, the philanthropic community. So getting all that done led us to, we've done all these efforts for the medical school, SunRail, the venues, And we can't celebrate those accomplishments if we haven't also taken care of the least of us in our community. And we need to focus an effort like we have on those others on the issue of chronic homelessness in our community. So this year, our goal is to end chronic homelessness among our veterans by the end of this year. The last 3 years, we've reduced that population by 60%, and we have the same effort going towards that we had towards Sunrail or the soccer stadium or anything else. So I am very pleased with that, and I think we're going to reach that goal.
Mayor Dyer, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Coming up next, Andre Bailey from the Central Florida Commission on Homelessness talks about chronic homelessness, and 90.7's Catherine Welch reports on efforts to find and help homeless veterans. We'll be right back. Orlando City leaders have a vision for the city that includes new sports arenas, new business, and a young, tech-focused population. But the city also has a problem with homelessness, and for years it's grappled with how to help the people seen wandering in the city parks and panhandling on the streets. City officials have come under fire in the past for restricting places and times where volunteers feed the homeless. But advocates say there's a change in philosophy on how to deal with the homeless, and it begins by getting them into permanent housing rather than just providing emergency shelter. Well, I'm joined now by Andre Bailey. He's the CEO of Central Florida Commission on Homelessness. Thanks for coming in.
Matthew, thank you for having me on again.
Well, it's been pointed out, Andre, how expensive it is to provide emergency services to the homeless. How is this housing-first approach different?
I think what we've had to do as a community, like other communities in this country that have grappled with this homeless issue, is admit that this cycle of homelessness, where we simply give people emergency services and try to rehabilitate them while sometimes they're living on the streets or living in, you know, places that we wouldn't necessarily live ourselves, that hasn't worked, even though it's come from the right place and come from the right heart. So this rethinking of how we help the homeless and this housing first model is saying that housing has to be the first step in changing someone's life when it comes to homelessness. We're seeing it work here, and it's worked around the country.
And to that end, some 70 city and county leaders paid a visit to Houston, Texas last year to see how they've dealt with the issue in their city. What did you learn?
Yeah, what's encouraging to local leaders and I think elected officials is that in the same way that we have struggled with homelessness, these other big cities, Houston, Los Angeles, Seattle, Atlanta, New York, you name it, big cities struggle with homelessness. It's an issue they face, each and every one of them. So we went to Houston and we saw a community that had the top homeless problem in the country just a few years ago, Matthew, that now has turned it around and reduced chronic homelessness, which is where someone has a disabling condition, a mental illness. Veterans traditionally have been chronically homeless. They've turned that issue around and reduced it 60% in just 3 years. So when we looked into that and got more information, what we found is, again, that housing first model was behind their turnaround and their success.
How much have they spent on it?
They've spent a lot of money, but they've spent less than not solving the problem. This is one of the things that we've seen around the country and in our community as well. There's a moral cost that we talk about all the time with homelessness, and that moral cost is you can't build hundreds of millions of dollars or billions of dollars in venues and transportation projects and not help homeless people. Like, you can't build a community and the social fabric of your community if that's the decision your local leaders are making. So we understand the moral cost of homelessness and not acting. But what we've also found, Matthew, is there's a financial cost of not helping the homeless as well. We locally studied 107 homeless people and found $31,000 a year is the cost in emergency room visits and hospitalizations. And so the cost of what Houston has spent is in the multiple millions, but the impact both morally and fiscally on their community has been exponential in its benefit as well.
Speaking of cost too, sending 70 people to a city for an in-person visit, there must have been some costs associated with that. Was it worth it?
Absolutely. And by the way, each person paid their own way to go, which is historic in and of itself, people willing to buy their own ticket to help out on a homeless issue. And Matthew, I think I kind of get the underlying question in your question, which is, you know, couldn't we have taken that money as a community and spent it on, you know, food or mm-hmm. spent it on, you know, blankets for the homeless? And I will tell you, like, those kind of questions are often well-meaning, but again, shows how we've thought wrong on homelessness. Now, if it was transportation, if it was tourism, if it was going to see a venue for basketball, then it would be fine to spend millions of dollars studying and researching and traveling. But on a homeless issue, you'd never want to do something like plan and organize. And I just tell you, leadership matters on this issue. And when the right leaders do on homelessness like they do on everything else in this community, that's when solutions happen. So that trip to Houston was so powerful, and it was meaningful because it shows that it's not going to be business as usual on homelessness. It's going to be leaders coming together, having the right ideas, and putting resources to make it happen.
What about the input from the homeless? Are you asking them what's best for them?
The homeless give us the most important input on our Rethink Homelessness initiative and our work at the Central Florida Commission on Homelessness. We're doing this veteran surge right now where we're out in the community. I just left my office, had over 100 people in my office just an hour ago that are hitting the streets right now, talking to the homeless, getting their names, hearing their stories. I told them, this is not about counting homeless people. This is about getting their stories, getting their information as long as it takes, because until we learn their names and hear what's important to them, Matthew, the Housing First model is built on the fact that we began to listen to the homeless and listen to them on what they needed to get off the streets. And come to find out, they might want medical care, they might want mental health, they might want sobriety, but without housing first, they weren't going to get there. So the homeless can tell us if we're willing to listen.
And that veteran surge comes from a pretty ambitious and lofty goal of putting all of those homeless veterans in Orlando in permanent housing by the end of the year, right?
Yeah, that veteran surge comes from the White House who pushed a few years ago that we can end veterans' homelessness. And by ending veterans' homelessness, Matthew, it doesn't mean you'll never have a homeless veteran again. It just means that unlike a gentleman by the name of Rick that I met just a few months ago who had been on our streets 20 years, a veteran on our streets 20 years, instead of spending the rest of your life on the streets if you're a homeless veteran, that we have the resources and the system to get you off the street in the matter of weeks or, at worst case scenario, in a couple of months. So we believe, again, with the right resources and the right idea, this housing model, that we can meet that goal.
Are you confident that you're on the way to meeting that goal in Orlando, at least Andre Bailey, of getting all those homeless veterans into permanent housing by the end of the year?
I have. The local VA, Matthew, let me say this. I'll be the first one to criticize government when it doesn't do what it needs to do for those in need. In this particular case, though, you have to give the national and local VA a lot of credit. They've put their money where their mouth is, and they've invested their heart, and they've rolled up their sleeves to help homeless veterans. This plan puts $15 million a year in more resources just from the VA alone, and that's add to that money that Mayor Dyer, Mayor Jacobs, and others have put in, and you've really got, again, this intersection, pardon the pun, of the right leaders, the right resources, and the right idea, which is housing first.
Has there been a total sea change, though, Andre Bailey, amongst the way city leaders, everybody sees homelessness? I mean, you talk about some people complaining about, you know, why do we have to change the way we deal with it? But is there still a kind of out of sight, out of mind attitude among some folks?
I have seen a historic change in the way our leaders, our business leaders, our faith leaders, our nonprofit leaders, I've seen a historic change in how we view the homeless, how we look at them and look at their needs and our commitment to help them. I remember being on your show roughly a year ago and, you know, looking at this great challenge we had ahead of us on this homeless issue in our community and realizing it would take these great leaders stepping up. And that's what we've seen. We've seen leaders step up, put money on the table, and be willing I think this is so key, Matthew. Be willing to say what we did before wasn't enough and it didn't work. I was so proud of Mayor Dyer, for example. I remember in December there was a report that had come out that 11 homeless people had died on the streets in just like the last 6 weeks. It was a story in our local newspaper. And Mayor Dyer got up in front of a crowd at a meeting that we had put together and had just hit the papers. And instead of deflecting or instead of saying, oh, we didn't know and I'm sorry that our office hadn't heard about this, he got up and he read each person's name, Bill Smith, Margaret Johnson. He read their names. He talked about how they had died. And he said, our community failed these people and we're not going to fail the next 11. And I'll tell you, that was moving to me because to see the leaders in our community, you know, take responsibility for this issue of homelessness, I've seen it and it's making all the difference in the world.
Are you in this for the long haul?
I am in this for the long haul. This is my community. I grew up here. I'm an Osceola County guy, Cowboys with a K. I believe in this community. I've seen it grow. And I just feel like I believe in helping the least among us. I just think that there's such fulfillment. This week alone, Matthew, I've watched homeless veterans come to our office. And you know, there was a gentleman I met yesterday. He was a young man, 23 years old. He'd been sleeping on the streets of Lake Eola for the last 6 months. He didn't know help was available to him. His name was Winfred. They picked him up this morning and took him into his apartment. I mean, just to see the life changes that are happening all around us. It encourages me personally, and so I'm in this until we solve this issue for good.
Andre Bailey is the CEO of the Central Florida Commission on Homelessness. Thank you so much.
Matthew, thank you.
Last week, hundreds of volunteers combed Central Florida looking for homeless veterans like Robert Stoner.
Army, E5, which is a sergeant, 72 and 74. I was verifying MIAs and POWs. That was my job.
Stoner was resting in the shade outside our studios when we came across him. He suffers from PTSD. His left leg is amputated below the knee, and the local VA knows he's out there. He's exactly the kind of person volunteers were searching for as part of a tri-county push to get homeless veterans off the streets and into housing. 90.7's Catherine Welch joined them on their search and has this story.
You already got a team over there, Evan?
We'll go this way.
Yeah.
We'll go around the lake this side.
Yep.
Dewey Wooden directs his team of volunteers around Lake Eola, passing families, tourists, and joggers, looking for anyone who appears to be homeless. The group wears matching bright blue T-shirts that say Rethink Homelessness and carry clipboards with forms to fill out, along with green and purple bags full of supplies.
Hey, guys, I see one green bag already. Did they already come and ask you some questions today?
Already did it.
Gotcha, no problem.
Most refuse to answer any of his questions.
At some of the other food sharings that I personally was at and engaging folks, people were kind of more willing. Here at the park, they're here now. There's a good chance they'll be here tonight. They probably won't go into a shelter. And so if they're in the park at this point, they're probably going to be a little more reticent to answer questions.
And this is where David Williams thinks he can be of use, connecting to the homeless, drawing them out. He approaches a man on a bench eating a hot dog.
You gave him all your contact information, though, didn't you? Man, it's good to see you, man.
Oh, nice meeting you. Nice meeting you.
Yeah, I mean, my life.
It's pure chance that put Williams here on this night at Lake Eola. 2 weeks ago, he was that man on the bench. But somehow he found out that there was something, he wasn't quite sure, but something was happening at the First Presbyterian Church in downtown Orlando. It turned out to be a press conference. Williams patiently waited until it ended, then went up front and told Andre Bailey, the head of the Central Florida Commission on Homelessness, how he was an Army veteran living on the streets.
I had a little money, so I found myself in hotels. Then I found myself at a friend's house. Then I found myself in shelters. Then I found myself under bridges, in abandoned cars, in abandoned houses, on the concrete in front of buildings. It just went on and on.
It went on and on for 17 years, until now. Because Williams just happened to be in that church when the city was focused on getting veterans like him off the streets, he is now on the other side of homelessness and on the other side of being regularly beaten, robbed, and hassled.
You know, a lot of times people take the smallest things for granted, like being able to go into the refrigerator, being able to change the channel, being able to turn on a light, being able to just lock the door.
That gratitude fuels Williams as he spends long days combing downtown Orlando, looking for other homeless veterans. He found one in the library. Wasn't sure he was reaching the man until he told him this.
That he's not alone. That he's not alone, no matter what. I think that touched him because up until that time, he had his head down when he was giving me the information. But when I said that, he looked up. So I think that touched him.
At Lake Eola, one or two people end up giving their information, none of them veterans. So the search continues.
Oh, good spot. Is there another one right there? Look.
Yeah. This time in Bithlow, a rural community just a stone's throw from the University of Central Florida. The HOPE team's Nancy Martinez and her group cruise the streets in her white Suburban, looking for worn footpaths into the woods, a sign of a possible homeless camp. Just off the main road, near the Bithlow Baptist Church, she sees a man walking down the street with a 14-ounce soda and a cigarette. He leads her to a trailer where brightly colored extension cords run through the backyard into a patch of dense trees. It's home to about a dozen people.
Where's your location? Where's
Can we walk back there? I ain't going. There's a bunch of other people living there, so I'm going to have to say no.
They call their camp Nashville, after the landowner, who they say charges them $200 a month to camp there. Scott Nash, no relation to the landlord, is the one who led us here. Drugs and alcohol drove him out of the family home about 5 years ago. He says he's clean and almost sober. He makes money taking day jobs roofing, but he wants a regular job.
Even if I could work at McDonald's with no high school diploma, if I made a couple $100 a week steady, it would be better than nothing.
Closer to the trailer, a couple climb out of their gray and blue tent.
And we are working with housing, and we are making it happen.
See, we need jobs. That's what we need.
Melissa Gogol explains how everyone here works as a team. And right now, the team is worried about Dave, who's having trouble with his colostomy bag. It's attached to his side with duct tape.
He rinses it out, and he has it duct taped on. He fell yesterday and it broke and he's got it duct taped on him.
Wow. The HOPE team's Nancy Martinez presses for Gogol to get Dave out of the woods to talk. She's seen people like Dave before.
There's a lot of doctors that are not going to touch that person because you don't know the severity. If he has not been in for checkups or anything like that, any doctor that does try to help, it can be a liability for the doctor.
Dave comes out of the woods and gives his information. Meanwhile, Martinez keeps her eye on the trailer. She's nervous. The landlord's been yelling through the windows that he wants these people to get help, but Martinez frets that he'll kick them out and they'll have nowhere to go.
Coming out here, and I'm really, really leery about us staying in this backyard. I think we need to move the outreach somewhere else because we're bringing too much attention. Definitely. I mean, you can hear the screaming inside. We have to get out of here.
Martinez and her team got information on most of the people living in the camp. She followed up on Dave, and just a few days later, her healthcare team helped him with the colostomy bag. Dave's a veteran, but he was dishonorably discharged, so it's unclear what kind of help the VA can provide. The week-long surge turned up more than half of the estimated 300 homeless veterans in the area. 41 of them were found in jail. Catherine Welch, 90.7 News.
The conversation continues later this week, Friday morning at 9 a.m. We'll talk about the latest news in Central Florida and we'll take your calls. Tune in. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Catherine Welch is executive producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.